Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Through life, we go through various experiences. Sometimes, when we're very young, we will have a situation that occurs we have absolutely no control over, and it affects us for years. It affects us for all of the life ahead of us. And that's what we're going to be discussing in a way and manner that I think is going to show you that sometimes there is a bigger picture behind the scenes of what we cannot see and what can have such a dramatic effect on us in our thinking, our behaviors, and sometimes make us aware after we finish going through a certain experience of why we may have traveled the journey in life that we have experienced and its value. My guest this evening is Stephen Rowley. His book is The Lost Coin. It is his memoir of his adoption and his destiny, as he has been able to see it as a man, a mature man. He is a psychotherapist. He is in Bainbridge Island, Washington. He has served in professional capacity as an elementary school teacher and principal and a school district superintendent, both in the state of Washington as well as California. He's been a college professor at three different universities. He holds a PhD in administration and policy analysis. He's got quite a background. Well, I think you're going to find his story as an individual, a very unique and an interesting one. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Donna. Great to be with you.
When you were starting to write this book, there had to be a reason why you wanted to really share with people what you had gone through. What was that reason?
Well, in an immediate circumstance, a little less than 2 years ago, I received notification through 23andMe listed as a first cousin who turned out to be the son of what I learned soon after to be a half-sister, whose father was my birth father. And up until that time, through all of my life, I never knew who he was. And suddenly, with no effort on my part, that name came to me, and as did the life stories and pictures of him and my new half sisters, but it was the completion. It felt like the completion of a journey, because I had been in search for my birth mother first for up until I was 40 years old, and although I was still interested in finding out his identity, the paper trail was cold, and there was no way I could ever find him. So I was shocked, to say the least, as were they, to find out that he had a child with another woman. But that time, I think, then I realized I had been collecting information and a paper trail of my own journey through bureaucracies and correspondence with adoption agencies and state agencies. So I had all the material there, but I think it took not only just the completion of the outer story, so to speak, of my search, but also had a sense of completion about what I call the inner journey, maybe a soul's journey. Which was also there from the beginning, trying to answer one question: who am I? So the book happily does not, in the end of it, does not try to answer that question in a kind of cogent, rational way, that has an interesting one, mysterious one, which I'm sure we can talk about. But by the time I found out, within 2 days, I started to write, and I wrote almost every day for 5 or 6 hours a day for about 5 months until I had my first draft done. So it was definitely in me. It was just a matter of this was the time. And now it was my time to write this, so it was just...
Adoption brings forth a lot of different experiences, and there are people I know that they were not aware that they had been adopted. And they finally find out when they're a teenager or even in their early 20s. And it's such a shock to them when that happens. And they say, where is my identity? Who am I? That those three words, who am I, are very, very significant. You have a quote in here by Alex Haley that I thought was quite profound. In all of us, there is a hunger, marrow deep, to know our heritage, to know who we are and where we have come from. Without this enriching knowledge, there's a hollow yearning. No matter what our attainments in life, there is the most disquieting loneliness. And when I read those words and then your chapter, Who Am I? This is something that really resonated with you, didn't it?
Very much so. It's almost, I would call it a theme almost, that I think runs through those of us who have been adopted. As you kind of alluded to, there's a different story for every person who's been adopted. And when it could come out of what I call the big surprise, as you mentioned. Some who knew from the beginning that they were, some not so much later. Some who found their parents, some who adopted. Those are all different stories. But to use Haley's words again, the disquieting loneliness, I think, is reflective of the trauma that happens through the separation of mother and child, particularly in infancy. So we carry, my argument, so to speak, is that we adoptees carry that psychic wound of separation, and it stays with us, and it creates a disquieting yearning in life. It can create a sense of loneliness. I said that if we in the adoption community had a theme song, it would be Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. How does it feel to be on your own with no direction home, a complete unknown like a rolling stone? That emptiness, that loneliness, that sort of seeking but never being able to find attachment on a permanent level, it's there in various shades and differences for every person. We're not identical in that way. But I think, there is what others have written about a mirror back in my own writing, a kind of the inner orphan. And that orphan is in perpetual search of stability and connection. And often for many of us, until we go through our own process, it can be elusive, if not haunting.
When you were adopted by a Midwestern culture or a Midwestern couple in a culture that you were growing up in, I found it fascinating that there was not any concern about race, and there wasn't any division relative to that. There was a diversity in the environment. And as you were growing up, you found out that outside of the environment you had been in, there were things called racism and poverty, and none of this had been visible to you. None of this.
Right.
You really were a part of a family that was just very, very special. How old were you when you said, and I'll use your words, your innocence had been tarnished? It's as if you were tossed into the trash can of life.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, I think in the book, I think the first major awareness was a trip to Chicago. I was probably 6 or 7 years old with my grandfather. We went to the Chicago stockyards on a cattle truck, and I saw these thousands of cows and pigs being slaughtered. That was a bit of an eye-opener. And then his great thrill was to take me to Wrigley Field to see the Chicago Cubs play. And on the way, it was the first time I'd really seen tenements and urban poverty. And it was an eye-opener for a bright-eyed white kid. Of course, then I get to see Ernie Banks play, and that was quite a thrill by itself. But that was the beginning of what I call kind of both a racial consciousness, and then also as I returned to later when my dad finished his surgical residency, we moved into a really nice home. I was aware that I was living in a materially better position than a lot of my other classmates. So that kind of class consciousness came to me very early. And I think it was, although sometimes it was disturbing, it was still in the long run a great benefit to be able to see something that I felt like other people around me either didn't see or didn't want to see.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's really quite an interesting awareness to see this. And your family, like so many families, they wanted to have the best for their children, and they didn't want them to see, didn't want you to see certain things. Yet you were brought into that, and it started a cycle of thinking and observation for you as an individual. And the class status, you talk about a relative, Auntie Catherine, and how her life was destroyed because the person she wanted to marry was from the bottom land. Then most of us, when we would hear something like that, we'd go, excuse me, what are you talking about? But we have to remember the time frames, and we have to remember there are cultures. In the United States, you can go from one state into another state, and the cultures are amazingly different. And they can be very different in multiple ways within a very small area of, let's say, environment. It's something that happens with human beings. It's really interesting. But you give a lot of information like that. And then the relationship with your adopted mother. This is something that was very, very unique, and yet she really did care for you quite a bit.
Oh, yes. It was near the beginning of the book, I talked about when I'm age 13, when I finally asked the question about my adoption, where did I come from, and I wanted to know more, and she flew into a rage and basically said, what's wrong with you? Don't you think your father, I love you enough? And I was so humiliated by that, and because she was really angry, and I ran upstairs, slammed my door, and vowed to myself I would never speak to her again about my adoption. In fact, I never did. In the book, I said I'm not particularly proud of that, but it turned out we had a different resolution I can talk about when she turned 100 years old. But it also became the impetus, it became the drive to want to know more. And both my age, 13, just 13, there was no internet, there was no Google. I wasn't going to be writing letters to people and having a letter come back to our mailbox. So I had to wait till I got to college to have my own mailbox, my own address. And at that time, probably around 19 or so, I began to write letters to my former adoption agency, the directors there, and other agencies. And although it was frustrating a lot, I began to develop a paper trail and began to understand how rigid the bureaucracy was in getting access to sealed records. On the other hand, I had a few other later directors who were quite helpful to me. So that struggle, I think, was almost necessary to go through. And also, I think, had I learned early, if I had been 20 years old and found out the names of my birth parents, I don't think it would have been right. In the beginning of my book, I quote a rookie talking about holding on to the questions that we have of ourselves, who am I? And his quote is prescient because he's basically saying, you may not be ready to hear the answer to the questions you have, so hold on to your questions and live those questions.
Mm-hmm.
So I was but the gift of having to live those questions for a long time. And even then, when I was warned in terms of when I began to narrow the search for my birth mother, that I was warned by a friend I might not find Elizabeth Taylor when I did meet up with her, and that surely turned out to be the case. Although that was, on one hand, a shocking revelation about how difficult and tragic her own life had been, on the other hand, when I met her and we had a few minutes together, a few hours together, the deep kind of connection we experienced with each other, as though we could see one another, see each other through the other person. And it's the middle of the book called Mother and Child Reunion. I dare say it's among only a handful of things in my life that have been so moving and so powerful, and seemingly so destined. It seemed as though, for both of us, this reunion needed to happen. It put some kind of closure. She died a couple of years after that, and it changed my life in ways that I still, I got married soon after, and a few years after that, became the father of an adopted boy. So it was life-changing in that way, but that's part of that. But the journey didn't end there. It was just sort of the midway point.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot, when you think about it, that goes into these stories of why a mother will give up her child. And there are so many different reasons that are there. But in your mother's case, and your birth mother's case, she got pregnant. She wasn't a teenager when it happened. She was you know, a nurse. She was a woman that, for her era, held a professional positioning, that she had had an affair with someone and got pregnant, and that it really totally destroyed her life. At the time when your mother was having you, women were ostracized for being pregnant. And she just knew she wasn't going to be able to survive, and sadly, it affected her very, very deeply. And she didn't know how, and there were not the resources around that she could have gone to, you know, a shelter or someplace for women and talked to somebody and could see that she had options in her life. So, in a way, she was a prisoner of a culture that existed at that time. And
absolutely,
that is something that really, really caused her so much trauma. That and the man who was your biological father and his lack of character and all of the story that you eventually found out, which you have obviously very, very, very well expressed in your book. So you have these components, and that had to have been something. You were in college when you found out about her. And when the term was said to you that you were an illegitimate child, there's no illegitimate child in on this planet, ever, as far as I'm concerned. That doesn't exist.
It's a euphemism, for sure.
But it is a cultural situation. And for her, and for the circumstances, then that's what you found out. When you had that label that was stated, how did that affect you?
You know, I don't think, or even the worst term, bastard child, I don't think it really was in my mind. I don't think I felt growing up I was, quote, illegitimate. But as I got older, and let's say when I became the age that she was at the time she gave me up, and realized both the difficulties and these sacrifices that went into giving me up for adoption, and the physical and emotional travail she had to go through to finally let that happen. I still never felt like a bastard child because I was well taken care of, but I felt that kind of more so the outcast, more mm-hmm. the abandoned child, more of, as I said earlier, the orphan, out of intent or just raw circumstance. And I don't think I ever doubted I was willfully set aside. I think I always had the feeling this was a difficult decision for her to make. I assume it was probably her father, drove her from Iowa to Kansas City, where I was born in the Willows Maternity Sanitarium. At that time, Kansas City was considered the hub of adoption in the United States. There were quite a few homes like this, and this was considered the Ritz. It was almost like a girls' boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
So for the short time she was there, maybe 2 months, I mean, she was treated well. But then 10 days afterwards, I was gone. I was, I don't know where she went. I assume she went back home with her parents for a little bit. But that's part of the journey. Instead of ending up right in an adoption agency, I was put in a boarding home. I presume either a single mother, a single woman, or possibly a young couple. And I don't know whether it was by myself or with others, but there I was technically under observation for a number of months. And that, as a psychotherapist, it raises the issue about what does or does not happen during that very formative period in terms of bonding and child development. Mm-hmm. It's a very special time, and I assume I was treated well, but I don't think it's quite the same as having a mother to bond to. So that kind of gap is sort of, even today, both emotionally within me and I think even intellectually, it's a real question. You really wonder what, you know, how has this scarred me? In what way can I relate to that? You know, it's a made relationship. Certainly until I was married, I didn't get married until I was 40, so I certainly had my share of girlfriends and so forth over the years, and never was able to stay in one relationship for very long.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that's part of the emphasis of the book is the inner journey, my own, and also sharing that and splicing a little of union psychotherapy and child development in that to give shed a different light on that, on the imprint of that trauma, of that separation, which I think is, I haven't taken a poll, but I'd have to think for many in my situation is there, even though it's largely unconscious, because these powerful events, they happened before we can remember.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we have no records actually to substantiate most of it. So we're left to our intuitive devices or seeking people who have different powers to be able to see back in time with us, or to nurture our own deeper intuition, which is what I get into in therapy, is kind of nurturing that, what I get people to talk about, leaving your sort of rationality behind and using your intuition to have an intuitive feeling of what happened before memory,
mm-hmm.
or how your behavior is the consequence of things that you made sense happen without knowing the literal fact. And that can be pretty powerful in therapy. And I think a lot of people, even though they don't have the background for this, resonate in those experiences of allowing the luxury, if not the necessity, to go back, go deeply within to find where some of the stuff first began.
When you are talking about these things and you are experiencing and reliving this in your mind, there has to be that sense of being an explorer and being able mm-hmm. to step in to a different modality that allows you to express yourself in a very different way than maybe you anticipated. And you talk about in your book synchronicity and how, because of what you were experiencing and what you were going through, and you still do this even today, you have become very open, and you've become through the years a much better listener and observer of many different people, different situations. And I'm sure that this assisted you when you were working in the schools, working with kids, because of what you went through. And when you actually did meet your mother, and you touched on this a little bit earlier, your half-sister, I believe it was, when she introduced you to her, she tried to prepare you, because your mother was in her senior years and was literally older, because she wasn't well. She was considered mentally unbalanced, and she, I think, tried to escape in some way into a mental world that allowed her to have self-worth or value, but she really didn't. She suffered tremendously, and then in that suffering, and you were able to see that, but your half-sister said, "My goodness, you are a spitting image of your mother. A spitting image, facially, you know, it's just, you're a man, obviously, but your face, everything." That really was interesting to read, how she said, "You're definitely her son. Nobody could even question that. You just, well, we don't look like her." But they, again, were of a different, you know, different father, but that bond between the two of you, it was extraordinarily unique, and you were not judgmental of her at all, which really, really think was a powerful thing to experience. No judgment here, just seeing her as a human being, and you really got a deep insight into her, even though there was just that short period of time.
Right. Well, it was a little bit of a deep gulf going on with me when I recall in the book my staff sister knocked on the door of this dingy apartment, and she opened the door crack, looked at me, and said, "Who the hell gave you the right? I didn't give you my address. What are you doing here?" And I just literally had to kind of remind myself just to breathe and keep my feet on the ground and be very cautious in that just that initial contact with her after all these years, knowing how lot difficult her life had been, and knowing how I had been, I was almost on the other end of the spectrum. She's in a half, out of a halfway house, and I'm fresh off of a PhD from Stanford. So, but after that, after once we got in the room, those things started to click. she started to talk about all the books she had in storage. She gave a little lecture on the Kandinsky poster on the wall. And for somebody who apparently had been wandering the streets with a shopping cart only a month or two before, was now lecturing me on European modern art, which just was absolutely dumbfounding. But it also rang the bell big time that we are a lot alike. I mean, I have a lot of books in the academic background, but it was more than that. It was just something about the way in which we both opened to each other so quickly and so authentically and so deeply that it was unmistakable. And you're right, it had no other expectation around it. It was just the meeting. It was just, you know, the reunion of that. Now, what, 40 years later, you know, we hadn't been in each other's arms since I was 10 days old, and here we were again, and I'm a grown man, and you know, she was only 60 at the time. So, but that to me was a gift that you couldn't separate mine from hers. It was just that mutuality, which I think far exceeded anything I could have ever hoped to have had experienced.
Mm-hmm.
So, it took a long time. Even then, it took a long time, just energetically in my own body, to get over it. I mean, I was still just like a bell that had been rung big time after I left a few days later and flew back to the Bay Area. So it was a. But I've kept her as we talk. I have done this through the whole writing. I have a picture that I described in the book of her when she was about 18, 19 years old. Cute as can be. Doesn't look like Elizabeth Taylor, but she does look like Jean Tierney. And when I look at that picture and see how fresh and innocent her life was at that moment, and now years later, it's just almost the opposite. So it has that tragic element to it. But also that's part of life, right? And I also, it's a reminder of what, if you recall, in the book, my half-sister, her oldest daughter, told me, wrote me a letter before I came and reminded me of the difficult circumstances of her life and theirs. And I thought, that's the bullet I dodged. That was the life, as much as I deeply missed the connection with her, it was like that was the gift of God to be able to not have to endure that life. That surely you and I would not be talking
mm-hmm.
today had that happened. So.
It really is fascinating how life will put us in situations, scenarios, and we think this is so unfair, we don't understand it. But if we're patient and we're willing to continue to live life to the best of our capacity, we often are given those little golden nuggets along the way that let us know that it's not a helter-skelter situation here, that there are things that we have been gifted without being aware of them. And that is something that I think was very strongly demonstrated in your life.
Now, those nuggets, I think, are another way to put it, different ways of seeing. That's what synchronicity is, not just a matter of coincidence. It's a different way of looking at reality in a non-chronological, non-linear, non-rational sort of way. It opens up to us and reveals what it needs to in that particular moment. And so the book is, I think, is peppered with a number of those moments of insight or that is the whole chapter on the Dalai Lama and getting a dream from him. That one's called Sharon Stone, The Dalai Lama and Me, which is actually pretty funny to read. But a lot of other little things along the way. And if we remain unconscious, then we miss all of it. And so as painful as those sometimes those recognitions can be, to me, they're the things that are the most, that's where the gold is, as Joseph Campbell would say. Where we stumble is where we find the gold. And so I've had this innate curiosity, not only about me, but about consciousness itself. And so the people I've run into, many of whom are in the book, including the work I did with a shaman in Seattle, all showed the way, or my own work in astrology, and I've worked with some terrific astrologers. They've all shown a light on not only my own life, but the nature of reality itself. And so that's my path. That's what has drawn me in the through line, if you will, in the book itself on a deeper level.
Also, there is a very moving aspect of your story. It's about a little boy named Eddie. And
yes.
How he came into your life, and you're a man that's in your middle age years. The last thing you thought you would ever have would a child. You and your wife were not even anticipating this was going to happen, but little Eddie comes in. And that, to me, was an extraordinarily powerful story because he was how old when you became introduced to him? And he had been badly abused.
He was 4 years old.
4 years old. Now, typically, they will tell you, when a child is 4 years old, that's pretty much whatever disposition you see, that's going to be their disposition for the rest of their life. And but that's not the case with Eddie. That's not the case with Eddie at all.
Yes and no. I mean, he's the sweet, adorable, charming kid that he was then. He's still the sweet, adorable, charming 34-year-old man that he is today. But a lot of the other stuff, the suffering from neglect, the death of his birth mother only a few weeks before he met him, and his birth father being basically on the lam at another part of the world. He had, you know, since my wife was a teacher, I'm in education, so he came to us with deficiencies. And that, in that sense, we could see that his intellect and his charm and his artistic talent from the beginning, but it took a couple of years to bring him back up to speed, so to speak, I mean, in terms of just basic school facts, for that matter. But he was so responsive. He actually asked us if we would adopt him at some point. Of course, it melted our hearts when he said that, because we were already planning on that. So, but it was that core, I think you're referring to also, knowing enough as I did, and being able to sort as I could intuit and see inside them. And I liken that to that trauma of neglect that he's and the loss of his mother, birth mother, like a miner being trapped in a mine. And I just, we both knew it in so many words. And it's like, we have to have this boy. We're not interested in having children, but he won us over in about, you know, half a second. And our instinct was totally rewarded. I mean, he's just a delightful human being and today. And, but that knowledge of like, I won't say to save him, but some way to rescue that part that's so shattered and broken that's within, which is typical of trauma victims. And I think as much as we can as parents to help resuscitate and nurture soul and bring him into and reinforce, like, which most parents I'd like to think should but don't, really try to encourage his, as Joseph Campbell would say, his bliss, his passion, his personal vision, not what we thought he should do. And that we've been amply rewarded for that as he. So that was another gift out of nowhere that was just landed in our laps, and probably the best thing that ever happened to us.
Well, I was fascinated with the fact that little Eddie turned to your wife and said, "I was looking for you for a long time. You are my mother." And that, coming out of the mouth of a child, that just was very moving to me, because he recognized both of you, and you being adopted, all of the things you went through, you and your wife. I mean, it's just, it's a fascinating factor that he entered into your life. And then for him to say to your wife, "You're my mother. I've been looking for you." And my goodness, that really makes you think, doesn't it?
It really does. Yeah, it was prescient. I mean, I think we experienced that. The meaning of that, it was just in the moment, exactly as you say. This was not something, you know, in the last few days. This was something on a karmic level. And we still experienced that with each other. We were just down in Los Angeles last weekend and spent time with them. It's kind of pre-Thanksgiving. It's just the same total enjoyment of being with each other, easy with each other, and really being able to. I mean, each of us have our own gifts, and when we're there, it's just such a joy to see him doing what he wants to do and what he's meant to do. So, and that his story's only started to begin at only in his mid-30s. So, but we were rewarded for reasons we may never fully appreciate. But it was that. But see, that to me also is that kind of statement. That's also the statement of the orphan who found something, who found the mother, maybe as much as I did in my own time and way.
Mm-hmm. Your story is a very moving one, and for anyone who is listening to our conversation, adoption for some can be very attractive and wonderful, and they don't have any qualms about it. Other people go through their own various experiences, and it has been my observation and conversations with people from all over the world that this affects everybody, as you mentioned, Stephen, in the beginning. And this is something that I think that is so important. Everybody's experience is different. You cannot put the adoptee into a box. There is this phenomena that goes on of connecting, and some people, they are not adopted. They are an outsider. I'll use the word you used earlier, for their entire life wondering what was wrong with them, that they were never adopted. You know, there's all this stuff that goes on in our heads. And sometimes that's because we are in a journey of experience that involves a great deal of self-discovery in a way and manner that could never be imagined. And your book, The Lost Coin, A Memoir of Adoption and Destiny, is quite a read, because I'm sure many people would read it and say, oh, yes, this is what I've gone through. Others might say, my goodness, I had no idea that it was so difficult to find out about your parents, your biological parents. There are so many points of information that you bring out in your book that I think are very, very special. And you have your own website, Stephen. You have your website. It's your name, Stephen Rowley, and that's ROWLEY.com. StephenRowley.com. And if you know of someone that maybe is going through an experience like this, for those of you listening, this might be a very good gift to give them so that they realize that they can have options to work with to find out the information that they know. In fact, there's even the DNA testings that are done that bring us in touch with people that we didn't even know existed. Stephen, this has been a delight. I'm so glad we've had the chance for this conversation, and I wish you success with your book.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate not just your questions, but the depth of understanding you bring into those questions. And I would say I'm very complimented by the fact you did a very deep read on not only my book, but my life, and brought that sensibility into the form of these questions. I just really appreciate it.
You're more than welcome. We are saying goodbye to Stephen Rowley. Check out his website, Stephen Rowley, and that's ROWLEY.com. We're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to Mrs. Sebo's Classics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Well, we have got a power-packed month of December with programming, and there are some changes that have evolved. But first of all, tomorrow evening, we are going to be hosting and airing the audio portion of the television program I've done on alternative health therapy. And that information is going to be in my newsletter that goes out. And then also on Monday, on the 4th of December, we have received a call from the guest that was scheduled, Marilyn Redmond, and she's very, very sick right now. So we are going to be scheduling her for the end of the month. So we may have a surprise guest on Monday. If we do not have a surprise guest, then it will be an open mic hour. You know, things happen and you just move right along. That's what live programming does. And then we're going to be talking about the Christmas mouse. Mm-hmm. This is a fat Christmas mouse. Walter Gieding is going to be my guest, and it's just a charming book. It makes a great gift, and it's a fun thing to share in the holidays. Then we're going to be talking with Ellen Everett Hopman about the sacred herbs of Yule and Christmas. Oh, this is a magnificent book. We're going to have such a good time chatting about it. And then Reclaiming the Sacred with Jeff Golden. And then Godlight with Bart Bartholomew. Also, we're going to be talking about The Girl from Wu Bang with PJ Caldas and so much more. So in the newsletter that is going to be out and available to those of you that have subscribed to it, it will be all of these guests are going to be listed, and then on my webpage with the newsletter, we'll have the newsletter posted, and also we will be having the postings regarding the guests that are coming up that you'll be able to see on my network page. So that being said, the very first Warriors for Peace program is going to be about public hostages. This has to deal with the institutions in the United States that have dealt with so many issues, and they're very serious issues today. We're going to be speaking with Dr. William Bronston, and we'll be finding out more about what this actually entails in depth. And we've got such a lineup on Warriors for Peace. What's going to be coming up is Follow the Pipelines with Charlotte Danette. This is what is at the basis for a lot of the conflicts that are occurring around the world at this time. And then we're going to be talking about the blockade breakers, the Berlin airlift, and the candy bomber. Helen Schrader will be traveling to Greece for that. And then former Judge James Bosnahan, we're going to be discussing his publication about justice at trial. You're going to have a back seat, or should I say a backroom view, of what goes on behind the scenes and actual activity of trials that the judge has done. So all of this and more is available. My television shows are up on YouTube as well as on my website. So those postings are all available. And don't forget the author showcase. There is so much that we try to share with you, and it is very, very significant. And it's with a great deal of satisfaction and a sense of accomplishment that I'm going into my 23rd year with my daily show and my 10th year with Warriors for Peace. So 2024, and we started television in 2023. So 2024, we're looking forward to having just as dynamic a year as we have had this year of 2023. It's hard to believe that 4 weeks from now we'll be going Happy New Year. Well, but first we're going to enjoy the Christmas season, and there's so many wonderful things that are going to be shared in the upcoming weeks, the last 4 weeks of 2023. I thought I would share with you this evening some fun information, and I really like the demeanor of this. I came across articles talking about mistakes that people had made that they thought very badly about, but in the long run, those mistakes ended up absolutely being super. And this one in particular, I really could relate to. And it was a statement by a woman by the name of Joanne, and she's in Florida. She said, years ago, I was making a chocolate cheesecake for a potluck. As I was mixing the ingredients, I was suddenly unsure if I had included the correct amount of chocolate. Overcompensating, she added three times the amount of chocolate that the recipe called for. But her cheesecake was a smashing success, and everybody said it's Joanne's chocolate truffle cheesecake. Much to my delight, she said. Can you imagine a chocoholic's dream in a cheesecake? I had a friend that fixed something like a triple chocolate cheesecake, and oh my goodness, it was amazing. Absolutely amazing. So here's a situation where this lady, Joanne, she just said, okay, I can't take a chance. And she did what she did, and it ended up being wonderful. Lots of times, that's how recipes end up being changed. A little thing like that. Sometimes it's an addition of something that maybe nobody else has ever considered. And by golly, that's how some of these bake-offs that individuals will win, because they've taken something that's ordinary and made it extraordinary. And then there is another woman. Her name is Jean, and she's in Kentucky. She's an elementary school teacher. And this is what happened to her. She said, try to clean 30 hands of children at the end of a class. She said, usually I would stand, the children would all line up. I would stand at the front of the line passing out paper towels. Now, this happened one day. It was a mistake. She accidentally dropped a full roll of paper towels into a sink where the faucet was running, and the towels were soaked. Well, she didn't have time to think about what she's going to do, so what does she do? She squeezed as much water out of that full roll of towels, and she stood with the children at the front of the line and passed out a paper towel to each one of the kids. She said, you know what? That changed my entire routine. She said, cleanup helpers love passing damp paper towels out while students wait at their tables, and everyone's hands are cleaned in no time. Well, she got to have an assistant. She found something that she did by accident that she utilized, and it worked wonders. This is something that I think happens more often than we care to admit. But by golly, she didn't ignore her mistake. She used her mistake. I think that, you know, it's a good thing that she made the mistake that she made. You know, for the past couple of shows, I kept talking to you about quinoa. Quinoa is an incredible protein that is, you know, it's a grain, but it is such an incredible protein that it adds so much to a person's diet, whether you're a vegetarian, a vegan, or not. It really is a very good grain to use. Well, there is a mushroom tart that I had a recipe for, but being that I have a sweet tooth, I thought I would share with you some quinoa brownies. Now, you may, if you're like me, you'll say, a quinoa brownie. Seriously? Are you sure? Well, yes, I'm sure. Now, think about this. If you were to fix quinoa brownies, you would find, especially if you had kids, that you're not just giving them something that tastes good. You're giving them something that is power-packed with protein and nutrients. So here's the recipe, and this recipe comes from Dan Jason and Michelle Ganes. And this will make 16 2-inch square brownies, and you need a square inch, an 8-inch square baking pan. All right, so here are the ingredients. 3/4 of a cup of organic sugar, and 1/3 of a cup of cocoa powder, 1 teaspoon of baking powder, 1/4 of a teaspoon of salt, 1/2 cup of dark chocolate chips, 1/2 cup of chopped walnuts. And if you can't have walnuts, I know people that are allergic to walnuts. They're few and far between, but they are allergic to walnuts. So you could use almonds. You could use macadamia nuts. You could use whatever nut you wanted to use. And you need one and a half cups of cooked. They have to be cooked. Red or black quinoa. And follow the directions on the package. And you need 2 large eggs. Remember, all of this has to be at room temperature. 2 tablespoons of coconut oil melted. 1/4 cup of milk. And 1 teaspoon of vanilla. Now, you're going to preheat your oven to 350 degrees. And use nonstick cooking spray or butter, whatever is your oil of pleasure. And put that into the baking pan. You also, if you want, you can use parchment paper. And make sure that you cut the parchment paper so that it fits the 8-inch square pan. On all sides, you'll need 2 pieces so that it fits snugly. And then when it comes time to lift it out of the pan, that's all you have to do. You just pull up the sides of the parchment paper and bingo, there you go. Your choice, of course, about how you'd like to do it. Now, this is what you need to do. You need to whisk your dry ingredients together. Also add in the chocolate chips and the nuts you want to use. And then your cooked quinoa and your wet ingredients go into the bowl of a food processor and you blend until it's silky smooth. And that's going to come out in about a minute. You add the quinoa mixture to dry ingredients. Stir until it's combined. Pour your batter into the baking pan. Smooth the top. You're going to bake it for 30 to 35 minutes until the middle feels firm to touch. Now, what was said with this recipe is that if you used a toothpick test to make sure that it's done, it really doesn't work for the brownies because you actually want them to be slightly fudgy. So dependent on your oven, if it's too gooey in the middle, which has happened to me, because my oven, I find usually I have to add another 5 minutes to whatever I'm cooking. It's just the idiosyncrasies of different ovens. So you cool it on a rack once it's cooked, serve it right from the pan, and why not add a little bit of ice cream on the side? Mm-hmm. They suggested raspberry. Raspberry and chocolate go together magnificently. Just like orange and chocolate go together magnificently. But seriously, you could have this and the kids are going to really like it. And you might be surprised yourself as an adult. But it is different. But it is also something that satisfies that chocolate craving in a very, very special way. And when I think about the holidays, I don't know about you, but when it comes to chocolate, or especially when people will give you some of their home-baked goodies that they only do at Christmas time, boy, you feel like you need to run a marathon to burn up all those calories. And the truth is, moderation goes a long, long way. So make sure that you take time to think about how much space you need in your freezer. If somebody gives you, as I have been given at different times, something scrumptiously delicious like homemade caramels or even toffee or something like this that you know that you have absolutely no resistance to, be grateful to the friends, write them a beautiful thank you card, and then stick it in the freezer. Do you know what? There are times that you'll find that going in and getting those sweet things will be just wonderful. They will keep beautifully, and you won't get freezer burn with them. Mm-mm. Nope. They keep beautifully in the freezer. Believe me, I have done that so many times, and I know some fabulous cooks. But, oh boy, it's one of those times in the year where you're going to have to really think about how many cookies you're going to eat or how, you know, what are you going to do to be able to appreciate all of those delicious things? Well, again, it's just moderation. But when I'm busy and I'm working on the holiday stuff, sometimes I'll find myself going by and just grabbing something And if you grab too much without thinking about it, it does, well, it does give you sort of that rounded feel. You go, uh-oh, I shouldn't have done it. The freezer is a great place for good things that are made by some of your favorite people that are absolutely marvelous cooks. And when it comes to the sweet stuff, that freezer comes in handy, believe me. I also wanted to share with you something about mushrooms. Now, mushrooms have nutritional components that science is finding dependent on the species of the mushroom. In the Asian culture, they have long been used for medicine, and they're known as fungi. Well, you can have an attitude about that, but the truth is, there is so much that people don't understand about mushrooms. And I know through the years, I've learned quite a bit. And for medicinal purposes, for health purposes, mushrooms really serve of something very, very special in the well-being of people. There are even components about mushrooms that the Asian culture has utilized in beauty products because they are just amazing. So, when you think of the white button, which is very common, you have the little brown button mushrooms. You have the portobello mushrooms, which are huge. They make delicious sandwiches. And there's also cremini mushrooms. Now, those particular mushrooms account for about 90% of what people in the United States eat. Now, there's over 10,000 types of mushrooms. And they say there's a lot more out there that we haven't even learned about. But mushrooms can have a very, what do I want to say, unique kind of a texture, depending on how you cook them. And a lot of people think, well, it is associated with mold, they're fungi, do I want to put that in my body? So there are so many different supplements today that you can find out about that really, really benefit the body. And there's a mushroom called the reishi mushroom. And they have found scientifically that that has an anti-inflammatory and an immune-boosting boosting component to it. And, of course, this has been known in Chinese medicine and Asian medicine, regardless of what Asian country you're in. And this is something that's very, very significant. So learning about mushrooms really can be quite an adventure. Now, I've never gone and tried to hunt them, find them, although there was a time when we were having portobello mushrooms growing in our yard, and we had people that came over, and I wouldn't eat them because I wasn't sure about the soil. But my husband had some friends that he told. He said, gee, we've got portobello mushrooms. My wife does not want to pull them up. And they said, oh, we are mushroom hunters. So they came over. Sure enough, they were totally edible, and they took them. So mushrooms are interesting, and their health benefits are quite good. So I thought I'd just give those couple of facts to you. I know that we're just about out of time. Do you know that there's underground mushrooms, and they develop networks of root-like mycelium? They are part of the composting system of nature. It's a fascinating story just to be able to read about it. They have found in their research that the mycelium actually warns trees about insects that might be ready to infest them, and they actually communicate. Mycelium is very much alive. It communicates via electrical pulses in very complex patternings. Well, that gives a whole different understanding about the plant world. Mm-hmm. By golly, we're learning more and more about things that shamans and people have known for centuries, not in the context of what we know, but what they understood. We're finally coming full circle. Donna Sebo here. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Be well. We'll be talking again tomorrow. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.